Welcome to the Strong Suit Podcast, where growing companies learn the right way to recruit rock stars. Each episode features one of the world's experts on recruiting the best talent to your company. Now, here's your host and five-time entrepreneur, Jeff Hyman.
Hello, and welcome to the Strong Suit Podcast. This is episode 97, and I'm your host, Jeff Hyman. Every Tuesday and Thursday, I interview a world-class expert on talent and recruiting so that you can build a company filled with rock stars. We're quickly coming up on episode 100, my special interview, my revealing interview with legendary venture capitalist Brad Feld. You don't want to miss it. Special on Valentine's Day. But today we've got a phenomenal guest, Jim O'Malley. Jim has recruited much of the amazing leadership team to Fifth Third Bank. And now he's partner at Talent Rise, which is a fast-growing talent organization based in Chicago. He's got over 20 years of recruiting executives to large companies, small companies. And in this revealing interview, Jim shares the three characteristics that define a rock star. He goes through a real-life example of behavioral interviewing, and he talks about when you should and should not sell a rock star on a position in your company. You're going to get a ton of value out of this information with Jim O'Malley. Here we go. Ready, aim, hire. Hey, it's Jeff Hyman, and I'm really excited about today's guest, Jim O'Malley. How are you, Jim?
I'm great, Jeff. Good to see you and good to be with you.
Thank you. It's good to have you on the show. I've known you for quite a few years, and I want to briefly describe your background and your perspective because it's pretty unique. And then we're going to spend maybe the next 15, 20 minutes really diving into best practices in the recruiting process to find rock stars and in equally important mistakes to avoid.
Right.
You know, a lot of our listeners don't do anywhere near as much recruiting as you've done over your 20 plus years. So I know you've spent quite a bit of time in search, in recruiting, and you were on the consulting side at a major Chicago consulting firm, Huron Consulting, as a managing director. You then were at Fifth Third Bank, where you led a lot of the executive searches internally. You attracted, from what I understand, a lot of the management team.
Right.
And then most recently, what is it, about 4 years ago?
Yes, 4 years in April.
Got it. You joined Talent Rise, which is a very high profile and high quality recruitment outsourcing company in Chicago, based in Chicago, does a lot of work nationally. So you've kind of seen this from all different angles. Is that safe to say?
It sure is.
Good. So we appreciate your
more angles than I care to remember sometimes.
And more gray hair than both of us care to admit. So why don't we start with I'll start with a bit of a softball, which I think is insightful, which is how do you define a rock star or an A player, regardless of role or industry or function? In all these hundreds or maybe a thousand searches you've done over the years, you must have identified some consistent DNA characteristics that apply to, you know, all the top talent. How would you describe that?
I would say I would categorize rock stars in kind of three buckets. The first one is they're leaders. So, you know, typically we're recruiting at the executive level. So by definition, executive leader, rock stars are true leaders. And, you know, you can argue whether you're born a leader or can you make a leader? And I think it's really both, right? I've certainly seen, but they stand out as leaders. They're magnets, to the talent that works for them. They attract that talent. They retain that talent. People want to work for them. So I think leadership is critical,
yep.
Probably number one, rock star quality. Number two is they have a subject matter expertise. They're very good at something, whether it's a technical aspect of what their employer is seeking. You know, if it's a financial firm, they're whiz bags in finance. If it's IT, obviously, they're leaders in technology. Whatever that subject matter expertise is, they own it. And that's often validated by the fact that they're going to be well known in market circles.
Right.
They're going to be out there speaking. Like I said, they're imminent in their space. And then the final element is rock stars have to be able to bring in business. As a leader of a firm, particularly the example is most apparent in professional services where leaders or partners are in fact the sales force.
Right.
But it's true for any organization, you know, whether you're the CEO of Boeing or the president of a manufacturing company, you are responsible for bringing in the customers.
We're all rainmakers now. I assume the exception, correct me if I'm wrong, the exception being the folks that make the product, technology, IT, that's not what you're referring to, or do you have a unique perspective on that as well?
And again, I think the question is, what makes a rock star leader? And it's really those three traits. Even the vice president of engineering, who might have a very specific role around the construct of whatever that product is for the organization, they're going to be attracting business by their capability to produce a product that's cost effective.
So it's indirect, but they need to have a market mindset.
Absolutely. I think that's really the market mindset is exactly, I think, the point.
We've both recruited and met many technologists who don't have that. They love the technology for technology's sake. And it seems like the world is evolving to needing and demanding technologists who are market and customer focused as opposed to just technology focused.
Well, you just hit it on the head, Jeff. You'll recall back in the late 1990s, early 2000s, there was a lot of strong technology professionals, but they were trying to get their product to market. And those that were successful had the trait of being market-minded. Yeah. Those that failed, they were just really good technologists.
Got it. So let's talk about how you identify these three characteristics: leadership, domain expertise, and rainmaking ability, regardless of position. Well, let's start with rainmaking or selling. Are you asking people what their numbers were? Are you looking at W-2s? And what if the person was not in a line role? They were, you know, not in a sales role or rainmaking role, but you want to see if they had that market orientation. How do you do that?
Yeah, great question. So we borrow a case from kind of basic interviewing one-on-one. If you go back to how organizations interview individuals at the campus level, people that don't have any experience.
You're just looking at potential.
They're really looking at potential, but they're trying to dig into previous behaviors, what they've done in the past that might be reflective of or demonstrative of what they might do in the future. And so that notion of behavioral interviewing is a big part of what we do.
A lot of people talk about behavioral interviewing. For those that don't know that term, can you break that down or give an example?
Very simply put, it's, again, previous behaviors kind of are a good indicator of how you will react or perform in the future. So it's really kind of breaking down, asking questions like what, why, how, when, and asking individuals to get very specific about that. It's a kind of, in one part, kind of a critical thinking exercise, and another part, it's a problem-solving exercise.
Let's say as opposed to what mistakes do you see interviewers make that are not useful questions or predictive questions?
Well, I think in a lot of cases, interviewers are looking to kind of get a sense of comfort from the individual, both them feeling comfortable about the individual and them conveying a sense of comfort. And oftentimes it just kind of ends up staying at that. Let's make the person happy and comfortable.
These are BS questions.
Absolutely. And it's just, you know, so it starts with kind of a vertical scan of the resume and kind of going down the path. I think in many cases, individuals don't recognize the importance of preparing for an interview.
Yeah, I was going to say that many interviewers will walk into an interview, they look at the guy or gal, they pick up the resume, and they start asking questions. Maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I like to sit down for a few minutes before, 15 minutes, and prepare and think about, okay, they've got three stints that were 1 year each. Why was that? They stayed at this company for 17 years. They must have loved it. What was it about the fit? What do I want to ask? And I make notes in the margins. But it is a bit of preparation. It takes time.
Well, and again, the rule of thumb I've always adhered to, Jeff, is kind of the 80-20 rule. I want to be talking 20% of the time,
right,
which essentially should just about leave me only the time to ask the questions. I want the candidate or that prospect to be talking the majority of time. To be perfectly frank, in those scenarios when that balance is optimized, a lot of times interviewees are answering my questions without me even asking them.
How is that possible?
Well, they're talking, right?
Oh, I see.
They're talking, they're saying things, they're comfortable, and they may not be wanting to disclose the information that they're giving me during that discussion if I had asked the direct question. But
right.
But by virtue of the fact that it's more of a conversation, their guard is down, and they're not necessarily preparing for a specific question, but during the course of the discussion, I learned so much more about them.
So let me play devil's advocate on something that you said so I can understand it. You said we should talk no more than 20% of the time. How do you reconcile that with the fact that we're interviewing a rock star or someone we think is a rock star? They're very much in demand. They have multiple offers. We've got to sell them on the opportunity, on making the move, on the culture. At what point do we really go into sell mode? Are you saying that we should focus on the interview and then once we identify our candidates that we really want to spend time with, then we focus on selling, or do you do it in parallel?
That's a great question. In all frankness, I view them as two very separate discussions or conversations. Typically, by the time we invite an individual in for a face-to-face interview, we may have invested already 2 hours in that individual. And most of those 2 hours are, in fact, selling.
Oh, I see. So you're doing quite some of that up front.
Absolutely.
Got it.
Yeah, so when I sit down to actually interview an individual, there's an expectation set that they are going to be interviewed, that I'll be asking the questions, that I'm assessing them. So I have to judge whether or not they're ready for that. But for me to give my clients the due diligence that they deserve, it's got to be important that I actually have allocated a sufficient amount of time to really dig deep and screen those individuals.
Let's say I'm leading a smaller company. We're doing a mid-level search. We're doing it ourselves, not using an outside recruiting firm. How do we have time to sell a large group of candidates and then interview versus do the interviews and then focus on that selling time with just a handful of people?
Well, you might, if it's really just a question of I only have the time to get in front of this person once, then you probably are looking at maybe a longer session. Instead of a 45-minute to an hour interview, perhaps you're spending an hour and a half to 2 hours with a lot of that time up front, as you pointed out, selling the candidate, you know, putting the sizzle, if you will, on the opportunity, and then kind of quickly shifting to the assessment piece. But in all frankness, candidates, they want and expect to be assessed. If it's all happy talk, if it's all selling, if you will, they're going to be suspect. They're going to wonder, what is this really about?
Why would I join a club that would have me as a member? Something like that.
Good point.
What about a question I get asked frequently is the pros and cons of recruiting or extending an offer to an up-and-comer versus someone that's already in the position? So all else being equal, we know how much we can afford to pay for this position, whether it's our first head of marketing, maybe we're swapping out our head of sales. Are we reaching down to a level below and pulling up someone to the major leagues, giving them a significant increase in compensation responsibilities, but we can theoretically attract a real rock star because this is a big, exciting move for them? Or do we find someone who's already proven in the role already and convince them to change horses or change companies? Have you learned or seen which of those two models works best?
Well, I think what I've learned is what's more acceptable in the marketplace. And the more accepted view is that, particularly if a client is going to retain us to do a search, they want us to bring in that experienced, proven individual versus look at potential. However, let me play my own devil's advocate. I think the organizations that learn how to assess and bring in potential are ultimately going to win in the battle for the war for talent.
Why is that?
Because I think it just individuals are looking for an opportunity for upward mobility.
If they're taking a lateral, you kind of have to wonder, how good is this person? Why are they making the move?
That's right. As a candidate, you have to be suspect of, well, if all they're going to do is offer me a lateral, maybe a little bit more money, what am I really leaving for?
Right. So then you have to wonder, are they an A player? Are they a rock star?
Absolutely right. And again, so I think when we see this quite a bit in our professional services work, because it's almost exclusively lateral hiring.
Right.
I think and it's ironic, again, harkening back to how a lot of these consulting firms have been built. It was built on potential. They brought raw talent off of campuses. They trained them. They developed them. And it's been, you know, unbelievable success stories. But they haven't figured out a way to do that at the more experienced level.
They're looking for a proven entity.
But it's the same. There's been this pendulum shift within organizations as well. More traditional corporate organizations are also now looking for that lateral move versus, hey, I'm looking for a VP, but I'll take a chance at an up-and-coming director that maybe he or she should be a VP, and their current organization hasn't been able to pull the trigger.
one last question on interviews before we move on to kind of later in the process, and that is around leadership. You define that as kind of the first thing that is, you know, a hallmark or a DNA for a rock star. How do you interview for leadership? How do I know when I'm sitting across the table from a candidate, whether it's a potential CTO or product manager, whatever it is,
yeah,
that they can lead and inspire people?
Great question. I think we do that a number of ways. We try and triangulate it, if you will. Certainly back to our behavioral interview questions. Tell me about a time where you were working with a particular team and you had some challenges with respect to individuals in the team. How did you inspire those individuals to kind of step up, if you will? Example, if you will, of a behavioral question that might dig into the leadership. We certainly would do a lot of referencing. I think that's an area in particular where in talking to references, you can kind of get details from those individuals about what they've observed as an individual, that particular executive's leadership skills and style.
Right.
Finally, as it relates to style, we dig into kind of what resonates for them from a cultural perspective. You know, culture is a very interesting thing, and it's probably the most important assessment that we provide our clients. If we're not assessing whether or not that individual is a cultural fit, we're really not doing our jobs very well. And that's always a challenge. It's a challenge for a couple of reasons. People just aren't honest about culture and what they're attracted to.
People meaning the candidate or the employer?
Well, good question.
Or both.
frankly, it's both. Exactly. Yeah. I think companies speak about culture more aspirationally. When you ask it, what you'll often hear is more about what they want the culture to be
right. Versus
what it actually is.
Yep.
In terms of individuals, depending on their interest level, as they kind of go down the interview path, they get more excited about the opportunity. They tend to be a little bit more blinded as to whether or not is this a cultural fit. Oh, I can change that person. They're not exactly aligning with what my views are, but I can change them. And so you can see where this kind of dishonesty, if you will, from both the parties can ultimately lead to failure.
Is that why so many of these moves fail? Is it just a disconnect? It's less about skill set and more about fit and culture and mismatch between the individual and their manager.
That's our view, Jeff. And, you know, we take that view very seriously to a point where, quite frankly, and we think this is a differentiator at Talent Rise, for all of our retained clients, we provide a 100-day onboarding and assimilation coach for that new hire. That's part of our fee.
Got it. I see.
We don't charge extra.
To make sure that they land in the position and get ramped up successfully.
That's right. The client is paying big money to place this person.
Right.
There's a lot invested. The candidate obviously has a lot at stake because they're making a move.
Yep.
They don't want to fail. And so that onboarding and acculturation piece is critical.
There's a great book by a Harvard professor called The First 90 Days, and it's just wonderful. I think it's very useful and instructive from a company perspective because it gives a sense of how do you develop an onboarding plan to make sure no matter what the role is that the person's going to be successful.
That's right. And we take it a step further. It's beyond not just the business plan, but again, how does this individual realize as they go into the organization from a cultural standpoint, what are the norms and the non-norms? Where are the areas? What are some of the taboo areas that they shouldn't be attacking?
Right.
If an individual comes in with a business plan that's aimed at addressing an area that the organization simply isn't culturally prepared to address, that would be a taboo.
Yeah.
And that would set that individual up for failure. Again, working with a coach, working with the onboarding team from the client or the company perspective,
yep,
we can manage against those types of failures, if you will.
And if a company is not using an outside firm, they're doing it on their own, the onus is on them to develop an onboarding plan.
That's right. I mean, we can all recall our first days at various employers, and they typically are that kind of, you're lucky if it's a full day or...
Yeah, right. Here's the bathroom. Here's the sexual harassment seminar. Good luck.
That's right. And it's even worse for executives because there's that assumption,
yeah,
on senior person, you know what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. So in the couple minutes remaining, Jim, let's advance all the way down the process. We've found the candidates. We've interviewed them. We've assessed fit. We've done the references that you mentioned. Now we're going to extend the offer and hopefully get the yes. What have you learned in your 20-plus years of doing this that will maximize our chances? It's never 100%, but maximize our chances that our first choice candidate will sign in the dotted line and show up to work 2 weeks later. Or if you want, Jim, you could talk about the mistakes that people make that causes candidates to say no.
Well, I think first thing, Jeff, to maximize our chances for success, it's transparency. If the candidate did a good job throughout the process of being honest with the recruiter and telling him or her what their expectations were, were honest about their kind of current compensation package and the constructs there, then if the recruiter does their job effectively, they're going to have all of the data necessary so that when they go to the client with a recommendation in terms of what the offer should be, and again, typically our clients are looking to us for that. They're paying us as part of our fee to handle that negotiation.
But you're doing that early in the process. There should be no surprises on money. Like, aside from compensation, what other key reasons does the first choice candidate fall out?
I think they fall out oftentimes because there's just they just weren't 100% committed to the process. So, and oftentimes a lot of individuals that aren't committed to the process think that money might change their mind. And my point of view is it doesn't matter how much money you're paid. If you're not committed to this opportunity, you're not going to take it.
Right.
And so, again, it goes back to that due diligence, checking with the client at various stages. A lot of our executive applicants and candidates, they own homes. They're married. In many cases, a relocation would be involved. So it's really important for us to kind of get to know them very well, get to understand what their comfort level is. Obviously, given the housing crisis a few years ago, there are people that are still kind of upside down, if you will, in homes.
Yeah.
And so is the organization prepared to kind of help right-size that situation and want the individual? It's these types of scenarios, again, if we wait till the very end of the process to collect this data, we find out that we either have a candidate just simply priced out of the market, or they have unrealistic expectations to be kept whole, or they simply have buyer's remorse.
Let's assume that we extend the offer and we get a no, and we don't have a backup candidate. This is the one that we want. Is there anything that you've learned about how to turn that person around and change their mind? Or would you say once they say no, we shouldn't even try?
Well, never say never. I think, but I would say maybe one out of 10 or maybe even one out of 20 of those situations where a candidate says no, is it repairable or can we turn it around?
Right. It's not often.
It's not very often. So my advice in those particular situations is that we go back to the work. But,
yep.
You know, to your point, you don't want to be in a situation where you have the perfect candidate, but you don't have anyone else.
That's really the key, isn't it? Having your backup candidate.
Our job is to make it difficult for clients,
right.
Not to have one perfect candidate, to have several.
Yeah.
And make them really have to painstakingly decide which of these two or three are the best.
It also gives the employer the ability, the hiring manager, the ability to set a short timeline on the offer and say, you got 2 days to decide because I've got another candidate, and you're not bluffing.
That's right.
You have another candidate.
Well, and again, I have a point of view on kind of putting mandates on candidates. I think there are reasons sometimes to put a timeline on an offer, but seldom are those reasons enough to justify it. You want to give the candidate the impression that they're joining an organization that isn't going to kind of pressure them based on timelines to make a decision.
That's fair. To play devil's advocate, Jim, how do you balance that with if you do have a backup candidate, you need to keep them somewhat in sync?
Yeah.
How much time are you saying you make it open-ended, or you just give a good amount of time?
Never open-ended, but a reasonable amount of time. But again, back to that transparency,
right.
I think it's important for the candidate to know when they get the offer that, listen, you are our number one candidate, but we do have another candidate.
Yeah, right. So how long do you give? 5 days, 7 days?
Yeah, I think within reason, 5 days. There are circumstances where that might be extended to 10 days.
Yeah.
Typically no more than 2 weeks, however. Yeah. Is a reasonable period of time.
If they're not signing on the dotted line in 2 weeks, something's wrong.
That's right. Time is the enemy of all search.
Got it. Jim, this is incredibly helpful and insightful. How can people learn more about TalentRise or get in touch with you?
So first way would be to go to our website, www.talentrise.com, all one word. The other way would be feel free to give me a call or send me an email.
Okay.
Email address is Jim O'Malley at talentrise.com.
That couldn't be easier.
It couldn't be easier. And my phone number is 312-878-4104. Of course, you can always go to LinkedIn. My bio is there as well as on the website.
Great. Thank you so much, Jim. We really appreciate it.
Jeff, thank you so much.
That's all for this episode of the Strong Suit Podcast. The next step is to head to strongsuit.com, where you can join our free live webinar. You'll learn the proven method for recruiting rock stars to your company. If you liked what you heard today, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and write us a 5-star review on iTunes. This is the Strong Suit Podcast, where we show you how to recruit rock stars.